find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne.
Mindfulness is a topic we all come across a lot, especially if you spend time on social media. It's often mentioned, and there are also a lot of apps promoting mindfulness in some kind of way. But what kind of effect does it have apart from relaxing us, as it claims, and how does it work? And today we are talking to Paul Verhaeren, who is a professor of psychology at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And as usual, to get to know our guests a little bit more, we have our usual welcome game, and I will start 5 sentences or read out the beginning of sentences, and we want our guests to spontaneously continue those sentences. And the first sentence would be, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
See, that's not spontaneous, right? There's a long pause here. I was going to fill out with an astronaut, but that's absolutely, absolutely not true. I did not want to be an astronaut. I wanted to be happy.
That's a good answer.
That's a very good answer.
And the second question is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
Thumbs up.
It's also very solid. The third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is.
Run and meditate. And if there's time in the evening, go out for dinner with the family.
Also very nice. The fourth sentence is, right now I'm most fascinated by.
Actually, the question that Sophie asked, and it was rhetorical, but why does mindfulness do what it does? Because we actually don't know. There's indications, but that's kind of really fascinating to me right now.
Okay, and the final sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when.
When the house is quiet and our 16-year-old has done his homework and the dog is ready to tuck in, that's kind of like, yeah, everything's nice and at peace. Nice to start.
Nice. And we already heard that Sophie said that you are a professor of psychology, and we also know that as a kid you wanted to be happy. So can you maybe briefly walk us through how you got to your position and if that fulfills your goal of being happy?
Oh, that's yes. Wow. So I'm originally from Belgium, where I wanted to be happy, I guess. I did my undergraduate, graduate, and postdoc work all at the University of Leuven in Belgium. Did a brief stint as a postdoc in between, kind of like at the University of Potsdam. Also later on did a sabbatical for 6 months at the Max Planck in Berlin. So I have some connections in Germany. So I studied psychology. I think I originally wanted to help people, as many psychologists do, I guess, and I very quickly found out that people were way better off not being helped by me. And so I kind of became a cognitive psychologist, I guess, or research psychology. Or I could say I got kind of fascinated by questions more than by answers or by, you know, trying to do hands-on things. And during my brief stint as a postdoc at Potsdam working with Reinhold Kliegel, I kind of by accident met Tim Salthaus, who was doing research in aging. I was doing a lot of my work on attention, aging, working memory in those days, who invited me over to come to Georgia Tech for 1 month in 1996, right before the Olympics. And that kind of, we did, a great paper together, a meta-analysis that kind of jump-started my career. And it became kind of clear that if I wanted to actually continue in research, I would have to leave Belgium. It's really small, right? And so I ended up at Syracuse University in upstate New York, where it snows 6 months out of the year, and there's a cloud cover 9 months out of the year, and then I moved to Georgia Tech in 2007. I originally was a cognitive psychologist, meaning I did a lot of work on aging, as I mentioned, attention, working memory. And then a couple of years ago, I had this, I guess, wholesome midlife crisis. I don't drive, and so buying a new car wouldn't be helpful, and I already married somebody who was way out of my league. So I had to find something else, I guess, but I kind of realized that I was writing papers on working memory, and there's probably about 20 people in the world who were reading them, and out of those 20, probably 10 were sharpening their knives as they were reading them, and I wanted to do something that was maybe more helpful. I don't know. I'd been meditating for a long time at that time, and so kind of around that time, I think, kind of mindfulness broke through in the scientific discourse too, where it seemed like you could actually meaningfully talk about this stuff and people wouldn't think it was just woo-woo or new age stuff. And so I just started, the pandemic helped, right? We were all indoors and couldn't get people into the lab. And so that seemed like a perfect excuse to kind of start doing this kind of work, which I hope is slightly more helpful than what I was doing before. This is not a diss to anyone who does hardcore cognitive psychology, because that shit rocks. I mean, it's fantastic to do that, and, you know, to dissect the mind and all that kind of stuff. But I just felt it was a different path for me.
Because we are doing a block of thoughts, because we restructured the podcast, and right now our block is on attention. And we will, I think, in a few minutes see how all things that you already talked about relate to attention. But do you have like a short definition of what attention is? Because I think like it's really important to some of the aspects that you already talked about, and like how you view attention or what that is to you, maybe.
I think everybody who talks about attention has to quote William James, who said everybody knows what attention is. And right, we know what paying attention is, and then there's all kinds of definitions that people use for that. Like, you select out of the information that is available to you particular things. You can do that on purpose, or it just happens. Right, your attention gets drawn to things. It's hard to define attention without using the word attention, but it's typically something like that. Mindfulness is often described as a form of attention, and maybe that's why you have this here. It's where you pay attention on purpose. This is Jon Kabat-Zinn definition. You pay attention on purpose in the present moment, and non-judgmentally, meaning you accept what's happening in your attention right now.
Because you already mentioned mindfulness and that it is like a form of attention, but I think that attention sometimes is like something that happens to us, or I feel like it, because like something moves or something and our attention is drawn to that. And mindfulness is kind of, I don't know, but I think like many of us have like the hope that mindfulness is something else, because that we can train it. So like people meditate and try to gain like control over this. Is there like, or do you would say that mindfulness is something that can be trained, or is it something that is like born into us, like our tendency to put our attention somewhere that like is evolutionary relevant, maybe?
Well, it's both, right? There's twin studies where they look at, you give mindfulness surveys to people, because it's hard to actually measure it objectively, right? So it's mostly about your own personal experience. And when you do that with twins, you can kind of see how much twins are alike compared to people who have less genetic material in common. And so about 31% of the difference between people, I think, if I remember correctly, is due to genetic influence. Some people are just more mindful than others. Another way of defining mindfulness is also just say it's being present, it's being there for whatever it is you're doing, right? But it's also trainable, at least. I was going to say we hope so, but we know, if you do, there's meditation programs and mindfulness programs, and people get more mindful after going through those things. It turns out that they also have lots of other beneficial aspects. Most mindfulness trainings indeed use meditation as their core technique, although others just try to get like a cognitive kind of twist on how you look at the world. And I mean cognitive as in cognitive therapy, right? And so we actually still, I think, don't really know which of aspects of those definition of mindfulness is really the important one. Is it really about paying attention, or is it about being accepting, allowing, non-judgmental, right? Which is a kind of a flavor of attention that cognitive psychologists typically don't talk about, because we talk about attention as the spotlight, and maybe we look at a particular content, the heat map of where your attention is, but we don't actually really talk about what's happening in terms of how you then deal with those contents.
You already mentioned like different kinds of mindfulness training. And I think like most of us who have like done a mindfulness app or something, like the main focus is always like the meditation. But you already said that there are like different kinds, and that we can also be like less judgmental of things. And that is also some aspect of mindfulness. Like what do those other practices look like? Or like what are the other things that can improve your mindfulness if it's not meditating?
Yeah, so you can call meditation something like a formal practice. That's what it's often called. And there are many informal practices people can do. And in most mindfulness programs, you will also do those. The classic one is eating a raisin mindfully and very slowly. So in that case, you're raisins are foreign objects, right? They're weird. They're alien. They have these wrinkles. It's a weird surface. If you bite into them, their texture is really strange, etc. So it's not about the raisin, but one mindful activity could be your first sip of tea or coffee in the morning or something like that. So bringing your attention to that object, but then also just noticing what is happening. And it's, I think, that noticing without necessarily wanting to change it that might be a really important aspect of mindfulness. Other informal practices are taking a walk and seeing what happens. In our mindfulness, in the mindfulness programs here, very often we ask people to just pick an activity every week, like brushing your teeth or taking a shower, and just do that with your full attention. These are things we normally do while our mind is racing or doing other things, or your mind just goes blank while you do them, and now you pay attention to the sensations, to the emotions that these things evoke, etc.
You already touched on how mindfulness can be researched, but can you also explain a little bit how attention is usually researched?
There are lots of ways of looking at attention, right? One is to look at how good you are at controlling your attention. Classical task for that is the Stroop task, where you see words in a color, so blue color words, and they denote words of color. So you see the word red in blue or the word green in yellow, and you have to say what the color of the ink is. That's really hard for people because reading is automatic. So you read the word red, but it's printed in blue, so you have to say blue. That's one classical way of looking at attention. It's typically called inhibition. Another one is to look at how good you are at switching between different things. We call that multitasking. I'm very curious to hear what the word for multitasking is in German, actually. Is there a word for multitasking?
I think we just use multitasking.
There you go. So that's another aspect of attention. Another one is how long you can be attentive for. So you can, for instance, use a task where you put people in front of a computer for 4 minutes and there's digits that appear and you have to press a button that says if they're odd or even, except if it's the digit 2, then you don't press a button. And so you can see that people are really good at the beginning, then in the end, they forget. So different tasks like that.
And if we now put the two things together, so is there a way of, first of all, measuring how mindful someone is, and then to measure something about their attention capabilities? Because like you said, like if there is a word and it has a color, but the word forms also a color, then we can already like measure like reaction times or something. So like we can probably have some quantitative measure of these attention mechanisms, but is there also a measure of mindfulness?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so it's really hard to get at mindfulness objectively through behavior. I mean, people have tried. There's one measure of mindfulness where you ask people to count their breaths over whatever period, a minute, 2 minutes or so, and then you objectively measure their breath and you see if there's a discrepancy. I think that measures the are you there, are you present aspect, but not the non-judgmental aspect, right? So that's really hard to do. So mostly mindfulness is measured by giving people surveys. So there's the five facet mindfulness questionnaire is typically the one that's used for that. And so you ask questions that kind of try to tap into, do people act with awareness or do they go through their daily life on autopilot? Or it measures or it asks how people can describe their emotions or observe the things around them if they are judgmental about the things they do. So those are subjective self-report measures. They do correlate with stuff, so they measure something, and they're also reliable, so that also means they measure something.
And is there no research done to look how like a higher degree of mindfulness, I don't know what the proper term is, but like a higher value of mindfulness relates to certain aspects of attention. So if like being more mindful either makes you more attentive to certain things or maybe less distractible, or I don't know what like the relation of the two is.
Yeah, there's a literature on that, obviously, and like a couple of years ago, I did a meta-analysis looking at that literature. Meta-analysis means that you look at what other people have published and you do some statistical mumbo jumbo to kind of look at, you know, how that all fits together. I always feel kind of weird when I do meta-analyses. I mean, I think they're important because they bring the literature together, so you don't cherry pick, you try to find whatever there is, but it's all the other people who did the work and I just sit here and make Excel spreadsheets, basically. I looked at what you described, the correlation between trait mindfulness, how mindful people are typically, and different tests of attention. And so it turns out there is a correlation there. It's not huge, it's about 0.10. So that explains very little of the variance in attention tasks, actually. But it's significant for sustained attention, for inhibition. And it turns out that it's specifically the kind of measures that tap into acting with awareness. Are you aware of what you're doing that correlates with attention? You also asked if mindfulness can be trained. So some people go through mindfulness programs and there tends to be, you know, lots of outcome variables people look at. Some people have looked at attention as an outcome variable. And there you find the same thing. There's effects on inhibition. There's also effects on working memory and updating the contents of attention. So when something new comes in, can you replace what you have already? And attention switching there as well. And those effects are about a third of a standard deviation. So that's also not huge. It's less than what you typically get out of psychology experiments. There's this amazing paper from 1993 by Lipson and Wilson, who just did a meta-analysis of everything psychologists have ever tried in any field. It's the meta-analysis of meta-analyses, and I don't know why it's not the most popular paper ever, but it should be. So they looked at everything clinical psychologists, educational psychologists, etc., have ever tried. And so on average, psychology has an effect size of about half a standard deviation. I think it's 0.47 to be precise. So this is slightly less than that. And in the meta-analysis, we also compared it to what you typically find when people go through attention training in the lab. And so the effect is less than you would expect for attention training. This is not surprising because when people go through a mindfulness program, you don't train them on the Stroop test, you know, the color word test or something like that. It's something else. You go through meditation, but it seems to make you more attentive to some degree, which is, I think, kind of nice, because in a way, attention effects after mindfulness training are side effects, right? It's not why people sign up for a mindfulness training. I've never had a student, and I've taught a few hundred students now, and I mean college students, on mindfulness. I don't think anybody's ever said, I came here because I want to be more attentive. They all say, I came here because I want to be less stressed or less anxious or less depressed or something like that. So it's an interesting side effect of mindfulness training.
I have like a little, or I was a little bit surprised by what you just said, because when I started meditating, I don't know how universal that experience is or how much that is just like the one course I did, but the idea was to let like most things pass. So like whatever comes to your mind, it's okay, and you don't judge it and you then let it go. But that would kind of mean to me that you're trying to basically narrow your focus. So like there are like a lot of things on your mind, but you let each of them go. But now you have mentioned like working memory. And if there is some improvement in working memory, that would mean that our working memory gets bigger, so that that we can like maybe hold on to more things in our mind. And I'm now like confused why letting go of things in our mind should in the long term help us remember more things. Is it like, or do you have any intuition if it's like just the other stuff that is also there that you like let go maybe, and then have more space, let's say, for the things that are tested? Or do you have any intuition of how this works?
Can I chime in very quickly and ask for a quick definition of working memory? Because I think we all generally know what memory is, and that's the reason why we can remember things. But I'm not sure everybody knows what working memory is.
Yeah. So. Working memory is, and here it gets tricky because it's going to start to sound like the definition of attention, but it's kind of the stuff you can hold on to in your mind for about 7-8 seconds or so. So I'm looking here at you guys, so I see you and you're in my working memory. There's also an instruction I have in my working memory. I need to talk about something and give you the definition of working memory. That's also part of my working memory. And so that starts a lot like attention, sounds a lot like attention too, but there's more of the stuff in the back of the mind as well that most people would consider to be part of working memory, and it's not typically part of attention. But my colleague Randy Engel here at Georgia Tech, who is one of the big experts in working memory, would really say that working memory and attention are really, really closely related to each other, which may be the reason why you can train working memory, at least to some degree, through meditation training. But I love the explanation you gave about maybe one of the things that's happening is that your working memory becomes less cluttered because you just pay attention to the things you need to pay attention to in the moment, after you've gone through meditation training or something like that. In the meta-analysis, we also found that the effect was specific to focused attention, mindfulness training, and people who had gone through more open monitoring where, you know, you sit and you allow everything to float through. You pay attention to whatever comes up in your experience. That doesn't seem to have that correlation with attention. So it's really about paying attention to, typically it's the breath, right? In beginning meditation, taking paying attention to the breath and letting everything else go when it presents itself, that seems to be related to effects on attention. So maybe less clutter. Yeah.
In the beginning, I asked you to explain your scientific journey, and you have told it in a way that also correlates like your life decisions to your age. Is there anything to be found here on age? Like, because if I think like a meditation seminar, I may have like some preconception of what the people or like what the age group of the people who are attending that are. And you said that a lot of college students try to be less stressed. So is there any correlation between like mindfulness and age? Like, do people become more mindful with higher age, or is that like something that should be trained or can be realized as young as possible, basically?
That's a really good question. One of the things I was thinking of, because I was just teaching about it, I'm teaching a mindfulness science and practice of mindfulness class right now, is there's this work by Elaine Luders, who is looking at white matter tracts in people who meditate. And so white matter tracts in the brain is information transfer, basically. And so she found that with more meditation practice, you have more efficient white matter tracts in the brain. Meaning, she looked at this in meditators and non-meditators. Non-meditators lose a lot of white matter over the course of their life. Your brain essentially shrinks. That's the non-scientific way of saying that, as you get older. And so she found strong negative correlations between the intactness of the white matter tracts in non-meditators, but in meditators there was no correlation. So that suggests that meditation would be the cure for aging. That's going to be the quote here, but I think that's overblown probably, and it's one study, but it does suggest that there is something about mindfulness that can be helpful for cognitive aging. Maybe one of the reasons why I like to sit still for a long period of time or go running is that both of those actually seem to be things that are pretty good for your cognitive health. I do find that when I teach, 18, 20-year-old college students, that that's a great age to be receptive to mindfulness, especially because and college life, as you know, is a very stressful period in people's lives. And I think colleges are really good at making it way more stressful than it probably should be. And so that's a really great moment to start meditating, because it has stronger effects on things like anxiety, depression, stress, than it does on attention. It also incidentally seems to have effects on academic performance, which I think is really cool. I also did a meta-analysis on that a couple of years ago. And so there's an effect of about a third of a standard deviation on academic performance from randomized trials on the classes or people who go through a mindfulness program versus people who don't. And so calculating that back to Georgia Tech, that's about a third of a grade point. So that's nice. So yeah, you can improve your academic grades a little bit too.
I don't want to get sidetracked too much, but I have a quick question about like your general recommendations of mindfulness training. Do you think that like having a personal exchange with someone who is like an expert in this field is beneficial, or that people just should have the barrier as low as possible and go on YouTube and search for some training, or are there apps that you can recommend? Is there anything that our listeners could do right now to start their anti-aging journey?
I always tell my students whatever works for you. And I think this is really, really important. Not to this MBSR, but sort of the big mindfulness program that Jon Kabat-Zinn started in the States in the late 70s, mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, is really very intensive, right? So it's 8 weeks, you're asked to do 40 minutes of meditation, 40, every day. And if you just start out, that's really, really a lot, right? So now I was trained in the KORU mindfulness program. Now it's called MIA, Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults. That's a program for college students, and we start with about 10 minutes a day, and that can build up to 20 minutes a day. That's very useful, I think, because asking college students to just find 40 minutes in their day and do that, that's not going to work. 10 minutes is doable, and there's certainly, you know, leeway around that. Then there's apps, Calm, Headspace, etc., apps like that, where you can have very short 3-5 minute meditations every day. Those are also really good. And so I would suggest, if you like to do this, because that's another thing, right? I don't think you should force people to go meditate. It's if you're inclined to do this, do whatever works for you. And I would definitely recommend building up from something small, that's manageable, that's doable, rather than, you know, immediately throw yourself into an hour of meditation every day or something like that. We've done some research. I had one of my senior thesis students doing research on Headspace. And so she was following people every day. This is not attention, but so she found that on the days when people used Headspace, they were more mindful and they were less anxious the next day. So there's these kind of boost in the moment kind of effects that are really, really useful. We've done research on the MIA program here, where people went through a 4-week program. We asked them to meditate 10 minutes a day, and you find effects on well-being, on stress, on anxiety, on depression. And when we followed up a year later, we found that these effects had largely disappeared. There were still some there, and they were really only there for people who kept meditating in between. So it's really a matter of just doing the practice. And whatever you can do, if you're inclined to do the practice, to do this practice, that should be your point of entry, I think. I should probably also say, and maybe this is taking us too far, that there's something really weird about mindfulness training, because meditation is originally a technique that's used in a religious context, typically by professionals in that religion, right? So mindfulness comes out of the Buddhist tradition. If you actually go to Buddhist countries, it's the monks and the nuns that meditate, and people go to the temple and accumulate merit. They give money or they offer incense or something like that. Here in the West, it's lay people who meditate. And it's kind of strange that we appropriated this religious technique to, you know, find whatever mystical religious goal the particular religion has, to feel calmer and less stressed and more focused. And so it also depends on your goal. If your goal is the spiritual goal, then I think finding a teacher and working with that teacher is probably a really good idea. But if your goal is to de-stress, to be less anxious, to be less sad, to be more in the moment, then I think apps can be a really helpful first step. And if you can find a program where you are or a group of people to sit with, that can be really helpful too, even if just for motivation, right? We're psychologists, we notice if there's a group you sit with or you meditate with, then you're forced to come back, right? And you also get support from those people. So that's very helpful too. That was a long answer, sorry.
No, I think it's very interesting. You mentioned to build up meditation. So generally, the goal is to meditate longer if possible. Is there any research on basically length of meditation in comparison to how beneficial it is?
Yeah, not as much as I would like to, because what we would really need to do is, you know, have people go through the same program, and some of them meditate 10 minutes a day, and some of them 20, and some of them 30. And as far as I know, nobody's actually really looked at that. There's one study that tried to calculate how long people would have to meditate to notice effects that are clinically relevant, subjectively relevant. And that's a mouthful, but what it means is that, say, when you go through therapy for depression or anxiety, there's a moment when you start to feel better. How different are you when you feel better versus the beginning? And so you can quantify that, and then you can extrapolate that to meditation. And so it turns out that about 90 hours of meditation over a lifetime, within a period, right, typically gives you these significant effects. We don't know exactly what the dose is, but from our own work and work from others, we know that 10 minutes a day already makes a noticeable, or at least a statistically significant difference. So that's, I think, really good news. And that might be the de-stressing effect, but I think it also has a lot to do with what you mentioned about the ability to let go and allow your experience to be what it is and then refocus, allow it to be what it is and refocus. And I think that kind of effect, where you have all these repetitions, where you bring yourself back to focus, but also notice that you're off focus and then bring yourself back without beating yourself up, is a really, really important kind of strategy. There was one meta-analysis by Kieran Fox and colleagues that looked at brain structure changes in people who meditate versus non-meditators. And so they found that gray matter volume increases in the salient system in attention. Now I need to explain the salient system in attention. But so you can clamp down on attention, right? So you're in class, or you're listening to something, or you're listening to this podcast, and it gets boring, your attention drifts away. And there will be a moment typically when you go like, oh, wait, I was doing this and I need to bring my attention back. That wait a moment, I was doing this is what is called the salient system. It's the system in your brain that says, oh, I should be doing this. Am I doing this? It's kind of checking. And so it's that checking system, the insula and the anterior cingulate, for those of us who like neuroscience, that seems to grow larger with meditation. Well, it's larger in meditators than in non-meditators. And the next question is, well, maybe it's that people who are good at salience stay with meditation. But it also turns out that there's a correlation between how long people have been meditating and the gray matter volume there. So that suggests that it's indeed the case that as you meditate more, you start paying attention more to your internal world and external world and how they kind of fit together. So I guess the short answer is start somewhere. 10 minutes a day is absolutely good. And after about 90 hours or so of meditation, now on average, you will notice things that seem noticeable to you in terms of mental health.
And for the effects of meditation, so you did a study where you followed up after years of meditation, and you only found effects for the people who kept meditating. So
yes,
basically, it only works as long as you do it.
Yeah, but it's like, I think most other things are most other skills, right? I like to run, so if I don't run for 3 months because I have an injury, it's not that I have to start over again, but you know, the benefits are gone. If you learn to juggle and then you stop juggling, and we know this, right? There's data on this. If you learn how to juggle, there's particular parts of your brain that grow larger. And then if you stop juggling, they slowly go back to normal. So it's a skill that you have to continue. I don't want to be too, I mentioned the religious aspects, but so one of the things that always, that I always wondered about was, so the Buddha got enlightened when he was 35 and he died when he was 80 or something. He kept on meditating in between. It was not like, now, hey, I've got it. Now I can just not do anything anymore. And so I think everybody who's ever meditated knows that if they stop meditating for a while, that life becomes different. So it seems to be like a skill you need to keep doing.
I think I never looked at it as a skill, but it obviously makes sense if you also combine it with attention. I think that's something, yeah, I think that's where the question came from.
I don't know if I can add one thing, or maybe this is going to be long-winded, but one of the big puzzles for me with mindfulness is that it's such a broad spectrum thing. And I find that really fascinating. Like, if you go into therapy for anxiety, they'll work on your anxiety and it typically works, right? If you go into therapy for depression, it works. If you do attention training, it works. But it's very specific. So if you go into therapy for anxiety, that won't make your attention work any more efficient. And if you undergo working memory training, it typically doesn't make you happier. But so I find it really fascinating that meditation and mindfulness training has this really broad spectrum effect. So one of the things our lab is currently trying to do is kind of see how all of these effects work together, or if they do. So one of the things I love about mindfulness training as an effect is that it seems to make people more empathetic and more compassionate and less of a jerk, less of an asshole. That's called negative personality traits. That's a really strong effect, actually. But how do you get from paying attention to the breath at my nose to I feel happier, to I'm more open to the rest of the world? Somehow there's a lot of missing links there that we have no idea about. And so I find that aspect of mindfulness as a practice really fascinating. It's really, it seems to affect everything, not to magnificent degrees, right? There's a book on this by Dan Harris called 10% Happier, but I'll take 10% happier. It's not 100% happier, but 10% is fine. But it seems to do 10% across the board. And that's, I think, really fascinating and really mysterious.
I have one more question, actually. Are there, so we talked about a lot of positive effects meditation has. I mean, generally, I think we all want to be happier, more attentive. Mm-hmm. Are there any known negative effects in meditation that can come up?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's actually a point of contention in the literature right now. So it seems that at one point, I wrote a book about mindfulness, and I was looking at the literature about randomized control trials. In the NIH, the National Institute of Health in the United States, there's zero adverse effects that have been reported. On the other hand, there's a huge literature of people who are finding these adverse effects in people who meditate a lot. So they typically happen on or right after retreats, or people who do a lot of meditation. Some of those are, temporary, like lower back pain. You sit on a cushion and you're not used to that. There's also ones where anxiety or fear is one that often happens. And those are typically also temporary. But then there's people who report things like dissociation, where they feel they're not literally not themselves anymore, or view themselves from the outside. It can be very anxiety provoking. And there's two schools of thoughts on that. As a clinical psychologist, most clinical psychologists would probably say that's not a good thing. It typically also, gets better of itself, but meditation teachers in religious traditions will often say, great, that's what you need to do. You need to break the self open, and that'll lead to whatever benefits you have later on. So that's a really big question. As far as I can tell, looking at the literature, it seems to me that when you meditate the way most people meditate, 10, 20 minutes a day if you meditate, and maybe a retreat a year or something like that, a couple of days, 3, 7 days or so, you're probably going to be fine. If you do way more than that, you might have more of those adverse effects. But my reading of this is that most of those seem to resolve themselves naturally. And if you have a good teacher, they know how to deal with this. But there is, Willoughby Britton is a clinical psychologist in the United States who explicitly has a practice. It's called Cheetah House, for people who have gone through or are going through these kind of dissolution experiences and dissociation experiences and are stuck there. So that can happen too. Yes. Don't want to overemphasize that, right? But there's definitely that too.
No, I just wanted to build a broad picture, and because we talked about so many positive effects, I also wanted to check if there can be negative effects.
So you asked about letting go and the breath, etc. There's this weird attentional effect that's called the attentional blink. And so it's measured in the lab by that you show people a series of stimuli right after each other, so really fast. All of them are, say, digits, but there will be letters in between. And then at the end of a run, you have to say which letter you saw. So it turns out people can do this. But if you put one letter and then the next letter, within half a second of each other, they don't catch the second letter. And it's like, so you see 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, A. Oh, A, I saw the letter A. Yay, the letter A is there. And then you miss the letter W that comes right after. It's called the attentional blink, and because it's like you catch it and then it's almost as if you blink your eyes and you can't see the second one. So there's one study by Helene Slachter and colleagues, if I remember correctly, where they had people do these attentional blinks before and after an intensive retreat. And so it turns out that after a retreat, people just don't have this attentional blink anymore. They catch everything. And the standard explanation for the attentional blink is that you really have this, oh, I found this kind of effect, like, yay, I found it. And then you're just distracted for half a second. And so maybe what's happening here is that you've just meditated a ton and let go and paid attention. You just don't go like, oh, I found this thing anymore. You just say, I found this. And then here's the next one. And here's the next one. So your attentional system becomes more open. And less kind of fixated on things, which I thought was a really cool small sidebar in the study there. Well, it's an important study, but it's kind of a really cool small effect.
Yeah, I never thought about, because we had another recording on attention, and there we talked about what the opposite of attention is. But because if you are distracted, then you're just shifting your attention somewhere else. And but if you have a task and you can say oh, I didn't look at the screen and the numbers that came afterwards, but you say I still looked at them and I saw the numbers afterwards, but you missed the letter, then there is something that wasn't really conscious to you, but still took away your attention from the other letter. That's really interesting. And I think this is a good segue into the end section of this episode. Because you said you are happy that you found the letter, and then you don't see the second one. And I was thinking immediately of this cognitive load kind of model of the mind, and that comes from me and we also starting to study cognitive science, and this podcast started as a cognitive science podcast. So we always try to bring all the recordings back to where we started, basically. So I would ask you to maybe say what cognition is to you and what role it plays in what you are researching.
Yeah, I love that question because I don't know the answer, so I will have to look for it as I'm talking. I'm also not sure if I really want to know the answer because I feel that like I did some relatively hardcore work on things like attention, working memory in the past, and that's clearly cognition. But mindfulness is a form of cognition too, but it's very different. It feels different. Because it also has this motivational, affective, emotional, and ultimately social component to it. And so I find that in psychology, we tend to, and also neuroscience, tend to put stuff into tiny little pigeonholes, right? This is cognition, this is affect, this is social psychology. And when I started looking at mindfulness, I realized that I knew nothing about social psychology or mental health. That was just not on my radar, and vice versa. When you talk about mindfulness in terms of attention, which is how I actually teach it to my students, when we talk about the signs of mindfulness, that doesn't seem to be on the radar of people in mindfulness. So I actually don't know anymore if that distinction, where this is cognitive and this is not, if that's useful. Of course, we need to study something. But for me, I personally love that the cognitive work here is being more infused with, I could use a loaded word and say heart, something like that, right? That there's something more human to it, something broader. And that's, I think, part of why I keep doing this and love doing this, because I find that the really human being aspect, I guess, got kind of lost in my previous work that was just purely cognitive. And that's just me, right?
Is there anything that you would say that we talked about today that is really important? So like a little take-home message, something that we talked about that if somebody has listened to this episode that they definitely should remember, or is like a good thing to remember. If you're trying to take like should remember, trying to take out the judgment here, but like something that they can
That's
hold
good
on to.
Remember.
This is the Nike slogan, right? But just do it. I mean, if you're interested in mindfulness, for whatever reason, I think it's a great thing to do. And the second thing, I guess, is see for yourself. Try it out and see if it works for you. If it doesn't, that's absolutely fine. Like all the things we know about mindfulness is from people who do it. And there's a large proportion of the universe of people who probably are not interested in it. But and for good reason, but just see for yourself what it does to you, if you feel it works. And just because mindfulness seems to have these broad effects, it can be very surprising what it actually does to you. And that's a great thing about the practice of mindfulness.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for this very interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
Of course. You're so very welcome. Bitte sehr.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Leslie Volk, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.